So this is the 19th of July, 2001, and we're here in Iowa City. Byron, you were going to start, I guess, by talking a little about Culpepper.
Yeah. Well, that's a made-up name, of course, Culpepper and Merriweather. The angel of the show was a medical doctor in a town in Illinois. Has sponsored a lot of little shows and back then and so forth. And I think his relatives were named Culpepper and Merriweather. So, but it has a nice 19th century ring anyhow. So, but unfortunately, and I'm not sure of the exact reasons, because he certainly had a good little show, to my mind, the best small circus in America. Unfortunately, he had to sell it recently to another person who I don't know and don't know anything much about, except that he's a circus fan, and will, I'm sure, try to keep the name alive. But whether or not they were modern, by modern, the modern business practice, or whatever reason, a lack of attendance, which maybe all circuses suffering somewhat now, but whatever reason, and I haven't wanted that call and asking them because it's probably pretty painful. But in any case, to my mind, partly because I was in on the very beginning of it, and in fact, when I was working with another circus, Franz and Brothers Circus, the people on that show who formed the nucleus of the new group and the new show met in my trailer, and it was very much like those old movies with, hey kids, let's put on a show, and you do this and I'll do that. And it was a very touching kind of thing, so innocent and so non-commercial. And the first year the show was out, they played campgrounds, trailer parks and campgrounds, and passed the hat while they could get just gas money, whatever. And the second year, by that time, they could actually play a few dates under sponsorship and so forth. But it's still a matter of standing there and willing people to come into the show, as it were, when they drove by, and please stop and please come to the show. And it was pretty sketchy. But it suddenly caught on and became a rather well-known little show. And the title is still on the road, so I suppose it still is well-known. Anyway, Red Johnson, the owner and manager, had worked with Friends and Brothers, and Lynn Metzger, who was her father was a magician, a professional magician, and she was used to the road, and she has done nothing except maybe till recently be out of necessities, but be with shows ever since she was a kid. And one of the earliest sort of professional in one sense, but amateur in another, was the Circus Kirk, which is, as it might imply, had religious overtones and was sponsored by a man named Charlie Boas. And he took that show out and made a go of it, and a lot of people graduated from that show and went on to become professionals.
What was the word you just used there? You said it had a religious overtone. What would you call it?
Kirk, K-I-R-K.
K-I-R-K.
Means church.
Means what?
Kirk, church.
I said,
And it didn't preach or anything like that, but it had a moral, at least aspired towards a moral position as well as a, and it always was a little bit idealistic, even later when it had some things which weren't so moral going on. But nevertheless, he aspired to make it an innocent show, what they used to call a Sunday school show, in that he was always fair to the public. And
this is Red you're talking about?
Yeah. And I would say it was closest to a Sunday school show going way back in circus history, because you know he was never going to cheat the people or shortchange them or anything like that. And he was very sensitive to animal rights, I mean to animals' rights, not to animal rights people, in that he didn't want any caged animals on the show and that sort of thing. And if there's anybody who was shorted in the treatment, it would be the people on the show, not the animals. And he had spent quite a bit of money for Elfin named Barbara, who was awarded to him in a sense. They weren't going to sell it just anybody by a man who spent tons of money hauling over elephants when they were being killed and mistreated in Africa and so forth and India. He was awarded Barbara for a very low price, practically cost. And there was a time in which elephants ran up as high as a trained elephant was $40,000. And that's gone, they've gone down in price, but I think you paid $3,500, which is really very cheap in those days for an animal. And she was the sweetest girl, just a lovely elephant, and gentle, and everything you would want in a performing animal. And because he felt that she ought to have company, that she would be lonely for another elephant, he bought Connie, which was an African elephant. And they are, of course, more available than the Indian elephants.
Well, Barbara was an Indian elephant.
Yes. What? No, Barbara's African. But they were hard to get, Indian elephants, because for one thing, the Indian government wanted to keep them under control, and this is when they were still dealing with the English, and the English were importing them, exporting them, and they thought that shouldn't happen, so they cut back, got very strict on it, until unfortunately they had to make some money, and they started relapsing and letting their animals out. And so it was well intended, but unrealistic in financial terms. And poor Barbara, I mean, not poor, she's well taken care of, I'm sure, was so beautifully treated that everybody else had to do things, chores and everything early in the morning, except Barbara. All that she did was go for walks around, and I used to be the lecturer to high school, junior high school, grade school kids, and then I'd get the lecture on the elephant and Barbara do the headstand or whatever. And it was a good, nice educational thing, and because we weren't making up stories about elephants, we were talking about how much they eat a day and this and that and the other. And the real facts of life, and trying to deny those, the facts that they had to be put in a cage every day or a crate every day. I can't imagine doing that, putting an elephant in a crate who didn't want to go into a crate. Because even when they know they're semi, they're their own private semi and everything, they're sometimes a little stubborn about going in. And, but any guy, I can vouch for the fact this elephant was not mistreated ever. And well, there was one trainer one time who used to try to teach do certain things that elephants didn't want to do, and that's hard to make an elephant do what they don't want to do. And he got fired because of that. So sometimes she would not have put on a spectacular performance because she was only asked to do things that she might have done anyway, you know, I mean, just the movements that elephants make. And
you often see these images of elephants helping set up the circus.
Well, they did do that.
And did these elephants?
Yes. We pulled the top up originally by hand, but then she was so strong, and then we went to a jeep-like arrangement. But she was so strong, and she didn't mind pushing up. To her, nothing. I mean,
And help with the poles, or what would she do?
Help just push them up. We'd stick them in and get them a certain height, and then she would put her head on.
She understood?
Yeah, oh yeah. And just push them up with her head. And so she didn't seem to object. Oh, once in a while, she might not be in the mood that day or whatever, or saw something else she wanted to do. One time we were parked by a river right on a little island, and she just wanted to swim in that river, and that's all she wanted to do, so she didn't work a lick that time. But she, when she didn't want to come out, she didn't want to come out, so it was difficult to talk her out of the water. But to this day, the last time I saw her, she was just as happy as a bird over there. And especially since Connie was there with him, and the two of them were.
Is that generally, not when you have an outfit like that, that has a sweet temperament, is that partly their natural thing and partly the way they're taken care of, or are there bad, there must be bad elements?
You know, that's the way they talk about it. Oh yes, they're rogue. They ask about behavior with children, you know, is it good household, or is it something in the child, you know? So it's a mixture of the two, and that has never been settled in humans, you know. They never know which proportion is better. I'm all for good treatment myself. And I mean, I'm assuming that the elephant hasn't been abused. Now, there have been elephants abused, and not so much recently, but in the past years. One thing people misunderstand, that bull hook, which is very much shaped like I'm holding a cane, and it's got it's not supposed to be sharp, it's just something to hook under its ear, and just let it know which way you want it to go. And the trainers in India all are more liberal in their use of the bull hook, and they're nowadays, and people misunderstood that, they you think they're really hooking them, you know, with a sharp thing and all that. They're not at all, well, at least not intentionally. And the other thing, the only other training device they use as self-protection, public protection, is a cattle prod, battery prod, which can be unpleasant for an animal. But they never use it unless something was, well, let's say they have a child riding and then start acting up, and it'll settle it down. But they're very, and the other thing is retaining low voltage wire around the bull truck, or elephant truck, they call them both in the trade, which is very low voltage. And just give it a little buzz, you know. And so they just, in other words, they're not staked down now at all, on the ones on Culpeper weren't. And they just stayed within that parameter, which is a big space. And they didn't really seem to mind them getting a jolt. It was a very low voltage jolt. It's just like if you stuck your hand in a thing temporarily and got a little jolt.
What other animals does this particular circus have?
Well, horses mainly.
Tigers? Horse.
No, this he didn't want anything in a cage. Uh-huh. And now that doesn't mean that all those circuses which have tigers mistreat their tigers. Because Wayne Franz, I used to work with, was praised by the government for the size of his cages and his treatment of the animals, and he never had any heat on him whatsoever about that. But if you parked, as my, I always park right next to the cat, well, that was my spot because I was visiting on the show and I wasn't on the payroll at that time. And you can see the cats get very unhappy sometimes when they came in. But within that world, they were beautifully treated, I'll put it that way. He had just briefly a little giraffe, a baby giraffe.
This is who was he talking
about? I'm talking about Red.
Red.
Yeah, a member who's still on the show. had bought a little, one of those zoos, roadside zoos, and he saw this little giraffe and it was being badly mistreated. And so he bought it. He paid $650, I think, for it. For him, that was a lot of money because he was just a truck driver. And kept it until it turned out he had a bad liver or something, and, which he had all along. And so I don't know whatever happened to it. He was given to a zoo. And no apes, or baboons, or monkeys, or anything. Remember Clyde, the donkey?
Yeah.
One of our elders, this was on Francis, this was another animal named Oka, had big eyes for Clyde, the donkey. We'd just go over and butt it and pet it and chat. And it was a very sweet relationship. But the size of the circus, Culpeper, was limited to, they kept the animals under a tent, so they were not out in the sun all day and all that. I mean, the horses and the donkeys and everything, lead stock. Well, he had a camel, which he bought because he felt sorry for it. Camel had a club foot and limped rather badly, and he bought it because he felt sorry for it being treated better than the club foot. And the public stranger thought that they were mistreating the camel when he came to the ring and limped around, you know, being beaten and everything. In fact, he was not too good an actor because he wasn't very attractive, you know. Club footed camel spat at everybody. And,
right.
Camels are one of the more dangerous animals on the show. People don't realize that because they can kick. They have their legs are double jointed. They can kick sideways, backwards, front. And I personally saw a camel pick up a tent man who was bugging it by the head and just walk around with it. You know? So they can be ornery. But again, this one was a very sweet camel. And, on the whole, and you treated it right.
You were talking about, I don't know, maybe we could talk a little about the kind of people who like are in the show and what they do. And now you said Red is a truck driver, and I assume he does that with the rest of his life when he's not doing this.
Or no, he
or he was that.
He went to college and all that. And there are more educated people, you might say, on that show than any I was ever on. And
so these people who have, do they do something else too, or is this mainly what they do?
At that time is what they did. Now, the people, I know all the people on the current roster of the new show, by Tabana, the woman who does an upside down loop walk and trap, and what they call webback, which is a single rope that swings around and it's a graceful pose. And I think you would call an educated person because she reads a great deal and she's a great fan of John Irving, the writer. And I happen to be a friend of John. And I told, he wrote a book about a rope swing woman who was laid in India and without knowing her. And so I wrote him and told him, I know this actual person, you know, who does this and everything. And so he sent her a nice collection of signed photographs and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It was a very nice little thing. And I mentioned that one woman whose father was a magician, and she just had kind of a pickup education, but she went to high school and everything.
That's Lynn Metzger.
Metzger, yeah. And, Fred went to college, I think.
So there are people who, I mean, it used to be, these would be people who kind of grown up on the road. It was like earlier it was a vaudeville, more of a vaudeville.
Yeah, it was like vaudeville, and And that still has to be the case because every, like, what's Mrs. Ayala, the cook on the show, I knew back on Carson Barnes and so I worked with him on Friends and Brothers and everything, and their kids, well, Case did some beautiful photographs of them. They grew up on the road entirely. So they are in the old tradition of a family that stays together. And they're all grown up now and they're doing feature acts on the circus. And they'll stay in show business, I'm sure. And, but Cookie is one of the adjunct running the cookhouse and the, what's it called, the grab joint. That means a place where the people on the show can go get hamburgers and everything. And those are what they call privileges. And the most outstanding privileges are the concessions which sell to the public, the popcorn and so forth. And that can make a lot of money for somebody. And they're not inexpensive what they sell on show. But when you go to the movie theater, it's almost worth it.
Yeah.
And so, and it's all legitimate. There's no short pushing the change off of, well, so people scrabble around and saw this and get it. It's straight ahead.
You were talking, you know, when circus coming to town, or also I guess when this Culpeper Circus was just getting going and trying to generate interest or coming in and just literally asking, you know, telling people to come in. Weren't there, don't they depend a lot on families, you know, people with children and bringing children
in? Yeah.
And so I guess I don't understand why it wasn't kind of automatic that people would just come as a place to bring their children.
Well, it used to be. Any circus came to town, everybody in the family was
right.
And
well, there is a revival.
There's been a revival. I mean, so many, they've so saturated with images, visual images on TV, that to see an actual elephant standing in front of you and you can feel the ground shake if they want to make it shake. On the other hand, they have the lighter than dog speed.
Yeah.
Yeah. The pressure can be so light. And I've seen them move and not make a sound.
Wow.
And, but most people like the image of the head down, the ears back, or, you know, runaway elephant. We used to, with Wayne Friend, he would take them around old folks' homes, take the elephants out. And they just really please those old people who've grown up on circuses when they were young. And this one lady said, I've always wanted to hear an elephant trumpet again, you know. So Wayne would take it down and stick the trunk in the window and and the command is speak to make them talk like that. And what a sound, you know, in a close quarter.
Would she know it was coming?
Oh, yeah. Well, we'd say, now you're ready and all that.
Yeah.
And that was always fun to do.
That's great.
And elephant rides, of course, were part of the income. He would charge whatever going rate was, $1, sometimes $2. There's a lot more than that now, I can tell you. But, and they get a nice long ride, you know, on the elephant.
But there aren't that many small operations like this. How many are there?
Well, a couple of years ago I was at 14, but not that many now.
And they have a region they kind of work in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But they have to vary that region a little bit, because they play through that territory. And so don't know where they are now, but he would play Wisconsin, of course, go up in there. That's always a good circus state. And he'd play Arizona, California, because he was down there, could book it easy. And in recent years, he played all the way up to New York, outside New York.
Oh, so really all over?
Yeah, oh yeah, coast to coast. Huh. And north and south. And
travel by trucks?
Yeah, oh yeah. And that's a tale when you get to go. They're very expensive, those kinds of trucks. The tractors are very expensive. So they get hand-me-downs and they buy used ones from other circuses and so forth, and they make the rounds until they just fall apart. And so the every show carries, if they're lucky and can keep one, carries their own mechanic who can take out engines and put in second-hand engines and whatever, and do the brakes or whatever. And a good mechanic, you have to love their life because they can mechanic can make a lot of money, you know.
Right. Right.
So the food and the pay and everything is not that great on the circus usually.
How do the small circuses keep their, you know, their sort of star performers from going off with larger circuses?
Well, because if you're used to a small show, unless you have eyes for certain kind of, you really want to be a star on a big
right.
show and make a lot of money and like Ringling or whatever, you're either what you call a mud show person or big show or a non-canvas show like Ringling, who plays indoors and they stay in hotels and everything. So, but people who like mud shows, and there's a good reason to call them mud shows because they play muddy lots. That and they like the small family thing and the short jumps. They tend to jump, well, say 30 miles, 40 miles, although sometimes they make 150 miles. Like that jump.
So the jump is what's between cities.
Yeah. And, but if you have a good agent, he factors in the gas costs, tolls where applicable, and so they try to have save money by not jumping very far. So it's sometimes almost impossible to get somebody who's been through that territory and they have a bigger show like Carson Barnes wipes out these small shows. And they don't have now, they only have about 20 elephants left. What's that? And they have more elephants than anybody in the world as far as I know. And they've cut it way down.
Carson Barnes, you know?
Yeah.
That's an old show.
Yeah, it goes way back. I love that show. It's the old, it's the most traditional old show there is, with all the acts of a certain kind and all this, and a big band usually and everything.
Still together that way?
Yeah, let's say it's produced, but still, yeah. And lots of clowns and things like that. And sleeping quarters for people, not ideal, you know, a triple bunk in a 40-foot semi, something like that. A double bunk if you're elegant.
Right.
But, and the cookhouse, they have a good cookhouse, I must say. They have a wonderful lady that cooks over there. And they have steaks and things and all, you know, good stuff.
Have you traveled with them?
Oh, yeah. And I was offered a job over there drumming. And it would seem I shouldn't do that at the time. I shouldn't go off and leave my wife for a year,
I'm
you know.
Pretty
so, but yeah, I would. They all know me over there, and I can fill in any job on the show practically, you know, except I couldn't do the heavy physical lifting now that Wednesday. But
Carson Barnes is centered where? Like, where's their territory? Where are they?
Well, in Oklahoma, Hugo, Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
Hugo's a great circus town, some reason, a lot of shows work out of Hugo. And they have their winter quarters there. And they, like a lot of shows, they keep on to, in order to keep the summer employees, they give them winter jobs, feeding animals, whatever, doing, you know, and so they can hold a group together. I don't know, Red did that. I don't know, last year or two, I don't know what happened about that, but he had his, quarters, which is near Phoenix, Arizona, and they own it, I think the new guy owns it now. As it turned out, though, he's the next door neighbor to Carlton Barton. I mean, to Red. Uh-huh. I mean, contagious right next to the
new owner. The new owner.
Yeah, the new owner. Uh-huh. So it's easy for him to have known everybody and all
right,
that.
Right, right. I mean, that's kind of a good thing, because it means it kind of slipped into the family, in a sense.
Yeah, and I'm sure that I really don't know what. Well, I suppose it was financially. He owed this angel I told you about. He owed him a lot of money, and he, I think, had a bad season. I know the year before he was not doing very well. The show was good. The show was wonderful. Just maybe they had too much competition from other things and events, and football season in a small town is. Get overlaps into the season, and when there are ball games in town, just forget it.
Right.
You know, they learn not to book those towns.
Right.
And there are so many competitions now, so many people used to television and movies or whatever. But I still think it's nothing like the smell and the feeling of the smell of the outdoor, the grass, and the whole thing. Well, that's not the sentimental bit about it. I love it.
When you, during the time that I've known you, you kind of have two reasons or two roles when you go out. You actually be a part of the circuit, but you also were using it, you know, for your work. And
yeah,
work.
I was.
And how did you? I don't know. Maybe you could just talk a little about that. The relationship maybe between those two things.
Well, for one thing, first of all, I have an autofocus camera so I can get snapshots of things. I kept it on my TomTom, and the acts were waiting to come in or back that way, and you can't focus, of course, and look back and play the drums and watch that. So I would just take my snare stick, drumstick, and touch the thing, and I'd have it. I knew where they're going to be standing about what time, and most of the time I got something useful. And they were not posing,
right,
which was important,
right,
you know.
Right.
Because when the circus fans and people who come with cameras, they tend to drop into these poses,
right,
or think artistic
right.
poses or whatever.
It becomes tourist art.
Yeah, another form of it.
Yeah.
And but the advantage, being with them all the time, that's like, this was 2 years ago, I think, or 3 years ago. I was over on visiting Red, and this woman who I want to do a painting of, because I liked her wardrobe, and I liked the way she looked, and I liked her act and everything about it. And she would go and put on, change her shoes for the next act. And I knew that when that was going to happen, it happened the same way. She got into this contemplative mood, as a lot of people do before they go on. They're kind of psyching themselves up, or composing themselves, or whatever. And she would do this, and without any awareness that I was even back there, and I would get some pictures of her. And it'd be very much the same, but that's what I wanted. I wanted that particular thing, an image. And I have thousands of slides I've taken on all these shows. And they are usually what I call backyard shots. They're not standard act shots and posing and all like that. They catch them off guard, as it were. And I sometimes would sit on top of my trailer and up in there, and when they get ready and have spec, which is the big walk around thing. Not all shows have it now, but they did then. And all the animals, everything go around this tent, and the music play them around. And so I would sit up on top of my trailer and get pictures of them all congregating, and they weren't looking up at me. They were looking at them wardrobe or whatever, you know. And so I like groups of people, and I do it in war things too, but I have large groups of people together doing a professional thing, a work thing, and it's nothing like spec for that. I mean, they're all psyching themselves up, and animals are all there. And I love the way the relationship between the trainers and of the elephants and they would talk. They have these big floppy ears, you know, Africans do. And this guy lift up the ear and go in and talk to the elephant and chat, and she'd put her trunk back and chat with him. And they were actually having, it seemed as the way any of you could say animals have conversations. I know cats and dogs do. They were having a conversation about the nature of things and how the lot was or whatever, you know. It's those kind of things that I liked about it. I mean, when I go to wrangling, I've changed my mind now. I like to go to anything now, but when they used to have all these Broadway spectacular productions of women on in glamorous outfits and everything, singers all over the place and everything, I've never cared so much for that. I like the bravery of not being subsidized, not making a lot of money, and still trying to put on a decent show, and there's a certain innocence to that that I like. And I like a little show right now. I have so many friends over there. Every musician in the band I worked with at one time, the Yellow, and the clown I worked with, and named Kelly Miller, and that's to my mind. Again, a superior small show. It's traditional.
They were out of Davenport, right?
No, Kelly Miller. They played Davenport. Yeah. Kelly Miller is there from, again, Oklahoma.
Oh. I've got some, I think I showed you one I found one time, kind of a little broadside.
Oh, yeah.
From Davenport, Kelly Miller.
Yeah, we had. We played all over there. One of my jobs, unofficial, was to do the arrows and double check. The arrow man, there's always an arrow man on the show. His job is to go out and if you turn right on this, he says slow, S-L-O, meaning a danger ahead, an upside down arrow, look out, that's something bad, a highway patrol ahead or something. And as a word, as a language to these Arabs. So when we were around, be playing around Chicago, they didn't like, the highway patrolmen didn't like all this stuff, people, because they'd pull over a truck or a trailer and park it on the side of the road while you tacked up there. All this stuff. And so I would go around and they'd take them down, and I'd go back and put them back up. Like that. No, you just, we played some town which is in Des Moines, near Des Moines, and I didn't even know we were in Des Moines. You know, I should have known. We played a little town, I forget what it's called, but I was just following the arrows, you know.
So that's what you mean, you just follow it?
Oh, yeah, you just follow the arrows. Nearest thing to panic you get is when you don't see an arrow for a long time and you think you've blown the arrows, you know.
Right.
So people do blow the arrows a lot.
But these arrows, the sign language you're talking about was how they move from one location to another?
Yeah. And the airman jumps the night. He's a 24-hour man, too, usually.
I see.
That means he contracts for so many bales of hay. Getting, if for some reason the license hasn't been done right, his job is just to be a catch his trouble, you know, ahead of time.
Right.
But he also puts something in, it must be so tiresome, just get out and park the car and get out and tack up those.
So what all, what kinds of things did you do, you know, when you were in the circle, when you were taking part? I know you were playing the drums.
That was my main thing. Uh-huh. I was also what we call a show painter. Uh-huh. And I lettered on some truck all the time, weather permitting. I was lettering some truck and putting a tutorial on it. And
you did the front door too.
And I was the front door man. That means, in effect, head off trouble again with a drunk or somebody, or somebody's hassling you. And so they, and the legitimate thing where some father said, I lost my son's ticket or whatever. You have to make judgments on those things and take the tickets and tear them and be sure you put them in the right box and all that. And it's quite a psychological and social skill to know how to handle people in the front door. Because we had a front door man who was just got everybody so mad. That was, I remember, get his name. Anyway, one guy got so mad, he was going to drive his truck into the tent. But it was full house and everything. He was moving the truck out there, and I went out and talked him out of it.
Yeah. Don't do it.
I said, did that other, I said, what's his name, Dennis, Mike. I said, did Dennis give you a bad time, this guy? Was he just saying something to you? Because he had been rude to this fella. And that placated him, and so he didn't drive me. But he was drunk, and he might have done it, you know, mm-hmm. given up.
Where was this?
I don't know.
Yeah. So you would play drums sort of throughout the show?
Yeah, and before the show. Uh-huh. Or the concert, as they call it. Mm-hmm. And on some of the shows, if they had a side show, I'd work the box over there. And in some cases, I talked the show, outside talker. I'm trying to think what show that had the giant snake. Mrs. Walters, Clark and Walters. They had a really big snake, rock python. And I would take up the mic and say, now, folks, this is a snake that held Cleveland, Ohio at bay for 2 days or something like that. Make up all kinds of stuff. And then if they felt we needed it, they would go in and get the snake and bring it out, just a little bit, six or seven guys would haul it out of its box because it was in the back of a trailer, and bring it up and make the outside valley, as they call it, which is the word for valley, who originally started. And the valley platform is just what it sounds like, where the axe would come out, and, or they bring out a bass drum and a trumpet or something. And some way of getting attention to that act. And it's a very rigid protocol on carnivals about who gets the. You don't jump somebody else's valley, you wait till it's done and that's done. It's very elaborate kind of thing. But circuses is only one side show. All they have what they call pit shows, which are singalos or single attractions. We had a little boy, I had a 10-year-old boy who had a baby horse. And we, of course, talk it up, and we didn't bring it out because you would have seen it. And it he's a grown man now. He was here in Iowa City with Donnie with his, then the Shrine Show, when they had the Shrine Show. Uh-huh. I don't have it anymore. Uh-huh. The guys are luscious and everything. They're drinking too much or whatever.
What did Ella talking here about? Elephants just sort of being really dangerous? You're talking about giving a nudge, and is that like a warning kind of?
Well, it's just kind of a natural thing for them to do. I don't know. They move.
And then they stretch the beam.
Yeah, squash them against the wall.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Or they can be a truck or anything. But when the first thing you're around the show a lot, you learn never to walk in between them and a wall or something like that. And another thing is you never trust camels, particularly if they're in heat. And when they're in heat, or musk, as they call it, will help them. They are something else. They blow this sort of horrible saliva, and jowls puff out and everything. They're unattractive. Except for another camel will make
it. Sort of like our species.
Yeah.
I wanted to return to something you were talking, you know, about being in there. And one of the things that you were able to do for your work, get this sort of, you know, great record and all these slides and things. And you worked on site though too, right? Because I remember you had that little trailer for a while where you'd work in there. And were you working sort of, you know, I want to say you were talking about just the smells and the whole sense of the place. You're working with that as a backdrop, right? I mean, that's all.
Yeah, but I had to work small, obviously, in the trailer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was working with something like acrylic or some fast drying.
Right, right.
And these would be finished things, though, they weren't. Uh-huh. I mean, I consider them finished. You know.
Uh-huh. And, do you look at those? Do they have a different quality than the other work done in your studio, would you say?
I think they were more like, I hate the word sketch because I don't sketch, you know, whatever. But they were more like immediate impressions or one-shot deals, you know, rather than sustained. In the studio, you tend to take it off and then put it back and then scrape it and then do this and that and the other. And take a long time underpainting or whatever. But those were just direct, kind of one shot. For that reason, some of them were all right. I don't know. I don't think I have any of those left.
I don't think so.
You do?
They were small and they were saleable. And
So you were doing that when you were with the show, but then the slides and that material is what you'd use when you get back to your studio.
Yeah. And I don't always trust myself that that's what I really want, but with a camera you can say, well, half an idea there or something, or a detail or whatever.
Particularly the way you talked about doing it, where you know, it's this great kind of just slice you could take because they weren't posing this information.
And the thing that I don't have good shots of are the things that are far away when the show is going on. I mean, but I know, mentally I know, I've seen it so many times, I know the way they look when they, you know. But it's very hard to get a difference, particularly if you don't know the show. Like I own Cupper, if I could walk right out and sit on the ring curb and Red knew what I was doing, so he didn't mind my doing it. But on some shows, if they don't know you personally and don't know that you won't spook the animals and do this or run out into the ring or whatever, they don't like photographers.
Your liability.
Yeah. So, I never take shows without knowing the people involved. I never take pictures of shows.
I'm so aware of so many of your paintings having that they have a sense of, you know, there's an act going on, but they don't, they're kind of different. There's a resolve to them that is different from what you're talking about in the slides here, where you kind of have brought a moment together, a particular moment. And it isn't, they don't, not that it seems posed, but it seems more formal than what you're talking about.
Well, I have a large collection too of from magazines, old magazines. I've got Circus Report going back, you know, magazines going back 30 years, more, 60 years. You know, but they sometimes I get a detail from something that you couldn't possibly catch. I remember when I was very, very young, when we, growing up in Greenville, Mississippi, we lived near the showgrounds, and the show would be a big event coming, you know. We had a theater, movie picture theater and all that, but then we even had vaudeville then, but the show was another thing and another big event. And I would be out there before the first truck arrived, always, and just watching everything and hanging around. And if they sensed that you were okay, because you were obviously there for interest, they would be very nice to you. And I would do the same thing when they had the flying circuses at the airport. And I would go out, and I got given rides in those planes and everything. And I saw Hoot Gibson, who was a movie star, very famous. And he was so drunk, he couldn't mount his horse. And the poor man was stabbing with his foot to try to get on the horse and everything. And that just really shook me up, I tell you. It disillusioned me, in my, you know, in the original sense of who Gibson.
Yeah. Yeah.
But on the other hand, I saw a lot of things that were just very intimate. I mean, just practicing in the backyard and all that kind of thing. And they I didn't have a camera then. I mean, I maybe had a little brownie, but I didn't use it. I didn't have the nerve to do it. And I was accepted in the way I was accepted because of my father, YMCA, work in black nightclubs and all kinds of black places and events. They knew who I was, and I wasn't going to cause any trouble. And So they get to know you a little bit after a while. And then I worked with what's called a store show, which was a side show in the wintertime. And they call them store shows as opposed to side show. And they would rent an empty building as long as they made money. And they'd stay there a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, as long as they were drawing. And I would... It was around the corner from the YMCA store show place, and I told him I was very experienced in show business. I must have been 11 or something at the time. And yet I would clean up or sweep or do, you know, just whatever useful would be generally useful at this age. And part of my job was take care of two microcephalics, or pinheads as we call them. And Bill and Zambezi, their names were not their real names, but, and they were black kids from Africa. And they would take Snicker bars and just try to eat them and smear them all over their face. And my job was to clean them up, change their diapers or whatever.
And 11.
Yeah, 11. And I must really love show business to do that. And they had a lot of other people that didn't, you know, I didn't have to do much of anything about. But they found out I laughingly would call myself a musician. So I also could pound on a bass drum outside or play a little trumpet.
You also talked about Baby Ruth. And,
Baby Ruth, that was my job for her.
Yeah. And these people never, I mean, at that age, they never scared you.
No.
Their weirdness didn't scare you.
I didn't think of them as weird.
You didn't.
No, they seemed perfectly normal to me. I mean, yeah. I mean, if their job was to be deliberately weird,
right,
like a wild man of Borneo, you know, they kind of act foolish. And, but, I mean, they were just sweet to me. They spoiled me and took care of me. And, poor baby Ruth, you know, I told you she couldn't get up off her chair because that was a chemical toilet. And then she weighed so much she couldn't walk unassisted. So part of our job, my job, was with that rest of the crew to get her into the back of a truck at night where she slept in the back of the truck.
Do you remember what she weighed?
750 pounds. More than a bale of cotton. If you were up somewhere else, you'd say 750 more than whatever. You know, I didn't talk her, so I was too young to talk. They don't, people don't trust a young talker. But she was incredible. You know, I told you, so the hospital bed broke under her weight. She had an operation, and they couldn't get her lifted up, and she was vomiting, and she died in her own fluvium, as it were.
She had, while being operated.
Yeah, well, yeah, she had a tumor on the inside of her leg. And I wasn't, thank heavens, I'm not present at that. But, she was trying to gain weight. And that's why she had a nickname. She loved Baby Ruth. I don't get a Baby Ruth in the coat.
But those, like with a lot of people, just their childhood, something they walk into in their childhood kind of sets them up for a lot of things later.
Yeah.
And you get away from that for a while you were in college, but you, how fast? I mean, I'm just wondering how, if it was a constant kind of interest, or?
It was a constant interest, yeah. I never, as was music. As was almost any form of show business, I didn't know anything about legitimate theater much. I mean, legitimate theater. But.
And the solitary performer, the magician thing.
Yeah. And I would always go and we would have a magician like MacDonald Birch, who still remains one of my favorite magicians. He was so nice to me. Whenever they used to book them into the high schools and they'd put on their shows there, as they still do that. And I had to show up the day because I know he's going to have to unload all kinds of props and so, you know, and you use some professional help, you know. And I would carry crates and stuff in for them. And in a couple of cases, help them set up. Birch was just a marvelous magician. And he was very little known outside of a few spots. He played Southwest and the South, but he was very well known in those, in that territory. And he did a cutting a woman into six parts that were just beautiful. And I still like to do that. I don't like my magic now. I don't think it's all about $1 million sets and tremendous orchestras and showgirls and everything. Although that was when Dante the magician had the first use of beautiful girls all over stage and all that. So,
what other magicians did you know?
Well, he was the only one I knew personally. I saw all the other ones. I'm trying to think of that. I knew the guy from Arizona or someplace. I've gone blank. But,
this is sort of a non sequitur. I'm just kidding. Have you ever met Ricky Jay? Do you know him?
I know who he is. No, I haven't.
Seen. Pretty interesting. I don't know if you read anything about him. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. He's from Chicago, isn't he?
He's from L.A.
L.A.? Yeah. Who's a Chicago magician? I'm trying to think of. And his wife. He was well known in Chicago. I worked, when I call it work, that guy, Emil Hahn on Carson Barnes, had a band, and I played high school jobs with him and so forth.
Did you mention the magician was his name, Blackstone?
Well, Blackstone, he was a big league. I mean, he
yeah.
Really big league. He was just a fabulous magician.
But this, you had a show for a while here that you would take around here.
The spook show. That the difference was that the magic show was all illusion and nothing else but. Whereas the spook show was a film, mine was Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, and then you put on about an hour show doing illusions of, usually of a scary kind of horror show, I think. And the worst horror was the magician who was a high school age magician. Really seriously thought he could do card tricks and all that kind of stuff. He realized he was helping move trunks. He walked off in the blackout, which is when the lights all go out. He walked off the stage into the orchestra pit. I forget where this was. And you hear, ooh, wow. He broke his leg.
Oh,
good. So many writers have wanted to write the story of that, and I never did do it. They told me to do it, you know, because it was full of grotesquely funny stories, of course. We played Tipton, the Heartacre Theater. It's still there, the Heartacre. And this was Chuck Ruff, I think, who was working me on that. And he had bolts in his neck, you know, and everything, and I had on a mad doctor outfit. And a woman worked coming off work from a late restaurant saw us and fainted. And we were worried about it and patted her cheek and everything. She woke up and there we were, right? She passed out again. And it was time for us to go move some big finale illusion, you